Okay, well, yesterday we went back to the source of these ideas, at least for me, and noticed that there were other structures, metric type structures, which transform naturally under the action of a B field. So now I want to go back to the generalized complex manifold picture and introduce metrics in a natural way there. So let's just remind ourselves that we're thinking of so generalized complex structure is defined by various ways of defining it, but it defines a complex structure on the tangent bundle plus the cotangent bundle. And the two standard examples of this are symplectic manifolds, where you have the complex structure defined in terms of the symplectic form omega by this. And then we have a complex structure, which is maybe more straightforward, which is defined this way, okay? I mean, this, when I write I there, I mean the induced I on the cotangent bundle. Now, so what we see here is that a symplectic structure on a manifold gives an almost generalized complex structure, and a complex structure gives a generalized complex structure. On the other hand, if we're talking about a Kähler metric on a manifold, then what is a Kähler metric? It's a pair of a complex structure and a symplectic structure which satisfy some compatibility condition. And the compatibility condition is that omega, the two form, should be of type 1-1 with respect to the complex structure. And also, of course, that the metric determined by that is positive definite. So we could talk about, if it's just a type 1-1, then we had a pseudo-Kähler metric. So the obvious question is this. How do you describe that compatibility in the language of generalized complex structures? Well, what you can do is, you can look, if you look at the commutator of these two generalized complex structures, what do you find? You find that this is... Okay. So I'm afraid working with 2x2 matrices is a bit hard at this time of the morning. So let me just write it down. It looks like this, and this is equal to zero. When is this equal to zero? If and only if this is zero, and this follows from this. So this is if and only if omega x I y plus omega I x y is equal to zero. That's what the vanishing of this means. And what is this? Well, this is precisely the condition that omega is of type 1-1. It's a Hermitian form. So we see that the Kähler condition on the two-form omega is precisely the condition that J1 and J2 should commute. So what is the most obvious thing to do? It's to say, well, let's just think about this, the commuting of J1 and J2, as being a substitute in this generalized geometry for a Kähler metric. So let's make a definition that a generalized Kähler structure on M is a pair J1, J2 of commuting generalized complex structures. And now we, strictly speaking, if we're talking about Kähler rather than pseudo-Kähler, we'd better put in a positivity condition such that J1, J2, x plus xi is positive definite. So you see J1 is orthogonal, Of course, with respect to the invariant in a product, so J1, J2 is orthogonal, but it's also J1 is skew emission, skew adjoint, so J1, J2 is self-adjoint because they commute. So this really is a symmetric form, and we require this should be positive definite. So this is our definition of a generalized Kähler structure. And of course, because it's phrased entirely in terms of our initial data, T plus T star, the natural invariant in a product, the Courant bracket, because these things are supposed to be generalized complex structures, then any B field, any closed 2 form, transforms one of these into another one. Well, while we're about it, let's just think what the Kolaba-Yau metric is. Okay? So let's generalize that as well. So I've talked about, when I defined a Kolaba-Yau structure, generalized Kolaba-Yau structure, I was modeling that on the view of a Kolaba-Yau manifold as simply being a complex manifold with a trivial canonical bundle. But, of course, a Kolaba-Yau manifold can also be thought of, usually, or sometimes thought of, as being endowed with the Yau metric, the Kolaba-Yau metric, the Ricci-Flatt metric. So we need to produce an analog of that in this generalized context.
One more question. If you have two generalized complex structures, you have two canonical bundles. Which one are you going to declare to be the canonical one, the one corresponding to the complex?
Don't know, really. I've never thought of that. But I mean, I think you'll see two line bundles coming out in a minute anyway. So. I mean, there are two. I mean, there's a canonical bundle for J1, a canonical bundle for J2. You see, in this case, the canonical bundle for J1 is trivial because the symplectic is generalized Kolaba-Yau, but a general complex manifold, the canonical bundle is the.
So, in that sense, there is only one because the one is trivial, the symplectic one.
Yeah, but in general, as we'll see, there'll be a mixture. So, okay, so what I'm going to do in a minute is to give you a restatement in sort of ordinary differential geometry of what a generalized Kähler structure really means. And I think you'll find that it relates to something which physicists have looked at for some time. But at the moment, I just want to give a definition, while we're about it, of what a generalized Kolaba-Yau metric is. So an ordinary Kolaba-Yau metric is a Kähler metric with the property that the holomorphic N form has constant length. Okay, that forces the Ricci tensor to vanish. Another way of saying that is that, that I omega wedge omega bar is some constant multiple times the symplectic volume. So we can make a parallel definition here. I mean, the words get a bit complicated, and I do apologize for that, but I mean, there are so many generalized objects that we need a prefix of some sort, and then so a generalized Kolaba-Yau metric on M is let me put it this way: we already know what a generalized Kolaba-Yau structure is. So, on a generalized Kolaba-Yau manifold, remember the definition of a generalized Kolaba-Yau manifold involves a pure spinner phi. I'm going to backtrack here. I want to get a rather more symmetric description. So let me just say this. In fact, the whole thing becomes symmetric. So it's a generalized Kolaba-Yau metric is on M is a pair of generalized Kolaba-Yau structures . You see, I mean, in an ordinary Kolaba-Yau manifold, we have a pair of generalized Calabi-Yau structures, because we have a symplectic structure and we have the holomorphic n-form. So actually, we're going to generalize that by saying we have a pair of generalized Calabi-Yau structures with pure spinners phi 1 and phi 2, such that the pair, such that J1 and J2 define a generalized Kähler structure, right? So that J1 and J2, which are defined by these, describe a generalized Kähler structure as above. And now we replace this condition by using the Mukai pairing on the pure spinners, that should be some constant times that. So where C is a constant. Okay, so it's similar to this. So we have these two generalized Calabi-Yau structures. They define two generalized complex structures. I require those complex structures to commute, and this to be positive definite, and the extra condition I require is that this should be equal to this. So that's a parallel statement to this. And as you see, there's a perfect symmetry between the two sides in this description. Okay, well, I put that there. I'm not going to say very much today about this. Tomorrow I'll say more about that, in particular with regard to K3 surfaces. So it's this aspect that I want to really talk about, because you can rephrase this in a more amenable way. On the other hand, this is a very simple idea. We know what a generalized complex structure is, and we just ask for these to commute. Yeah? Which one? No, actually, it should be positive, actually. Yeah. Well, it depends, you know, I'm not quite sure about whether that C is this C, you know. But it has to have a definite sign if it corresponding to the positive definiteness. Yeah, you're right. So I don't want to spell that out. I know that it has to be positive, certainly in the two-dimensional case. I'm just a little bit unsure about what happens in the odd or even case. But sure, there's a sign on that. Okay, so so what is the reinterpretation of this? So this is something which was proved by my student Marco Gualtieri. So the statement is this, that I hope I can get it in. So a generalized Kähler structure is equivalent to the following. So we have a metric. We have G. We're going to have a two integrable complex structures. So this is just on the manifold itself. We're not talking generalized here. We're moving down from generalized to an interpretation downstairs. So two integrable complex structures, I plus and I minus, and a two form B, such that first of all, G is Hermitian with respect to I plus and I minus. Secondly, that if we take, so what have we got here? We've got an integrable complex structure and a Hermitian metric. So we know that there's a unique connection which preserves the complex structure and the metric. That's the Chern connection, I guess. So that if so we have two of these Chern connections, Nabla plus and Nabla minus, and if you take the average of these, then this is equal to Nabla the Levi-Civita connection. And if you take the difference, or maybe half the difference, then this is a tensor, and what it is a three form, which is B of this two form B. So we think of this then as a three form. So you think this is skew torsion. You have a three form sitting inside wedge 2 T star tensor T star. And then you think of this as the Lie algebra of SON, so that's the way in which you think of the difference of two connections as being a three form. So these are connections. Each one of these is connections with skew torsion, but with opposite skew torsion. Now, what do you call? I mean, this sort of structure has appeared in various contexts in. Yes. Okay. Supergravity. In fact, I mean, for me, it's a slightly embarrassment to discover this here because 20 years ago I spent a year at Stony Brook talking to Martin Rocek, and most of the time we talked about hyperkähler manifolds, and we wrote a big paper on that. But all the time he kept telling me, no, there's another structure which involves a pair of complex structures and this, and I never listened. So 20 years later, it's come back to haunt me. Okay, so these are the Chern connections. So Nabla plus is the unique connection on the tangent bundle, which is compatible with the complex structure I plus and the metric, the Hermitian metric G. So that's sometimes called the Chern connection. And so, well, and there's a corresponding one for minus as well. Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I mean, it's true. There's some interesting questions about trying to get away from exactness there. And in fact, there are examples on, for example, on a Hopf surface. So a Hopf surface, one can prove actually, is not a generalized Kähler manifold. That it, I mean, it has all of this structure except that this is closed three form, which is not exact. And it's slightly difficult to, at the moment at least, to fit it into this picture. Locally it fits in here, but there's some sort of other formalism, other set of words which we need in order to talk about the case where the torsion is closed but not exact. Well, let me, I want to give you an outline of the proof, at least in one direction of this, because it shows up a number of features which we've sort of encountered in various ways before.
In the Hopf surface case, is there a three-form integral
invariance? I think you can scale it, actually. I don't think there's any... No, there's no... Well, I mean, you could choose it to have, because H3 is just one-dimensional, but... I mean, there's no... You can rescale the metric in B, and then, you know, it's the same structure. Okay, so that's the statement. So I want to prove that this structure is derived from the generalized complex structure. Going backwards has a little slightly tricky point to it, and I don't want to get into that. So I want to start. So suppose that where I have J1 and J2 which commute. So I want to go from this position down to all of this data. And so, actually, okay, before I say that, let me just point out that I said initially that a generalized Kähler structure can be transformed naturally by a B-field, which is a closed two-form. What happens to this data? Well, the B goes to B plus big B, if you like, so the B-field action, that's just the B B goes to B plus a closed form. That's the B field action. Of course, it doesn't change at all the geometry, the differential geometry, but it's it's there in the picture. And also, I should say that, of course, a Kähler manifold, this is where we started from. You know, we started with a generalized Kähler structure, so an ordinary Kähler structure is one of these, and that's the case where, of course, I plus is equal to I minus, and the average is, the Chern connection is the Levi-Civita connection. And, B is not necessarily zero, but dB is equal to zero, because you can, as I say, you can change by a B field. It doesn't affect the actual Kähler metric. Okay, so now let's go back to this situation. So suppose that J1, J2 is equal to J2, J1. Then, of course, what we get is that J1, J2 squared is equal to minus 1 times minus 1, which is plus 1. When these commute, of course, this is... So what we have is an orthogonal transformation whose square is 1. So we can look at the plus 1 and minus 1 eigenspaces. Right? So we say, suppose V is the plus 1 eigenspace. And then this is orthogonal, so V perpendicular is the minus 1 eigenspace. Well, eigenbundle, I suppose. So what we've got then is that we've decomposed T plus T star in a different way as the direct sum of V plus V perpendicular, the two eigenspaces of J1, J2. And if we take this decomposition, if we think of V there and W there, and we look at J1, J2, look at the inner product on this, then J1, J2 is plus 1 there and minus 1 there, so this is VV minus WW. So what this says, so our condition was that for a generalized Kähler structure was that this should be positive definite. So that says that the metric restricted to V is positive definite, put W equal to 0, and the metric restricted to V perp is negative definite, put V equal to 0. So that says that V, the induced metric on V, is positive definite, and on V perp, it's negative definite. So we've already actually, see, got this picture that I've used twice already. Once when I was describing topologically what a generalized complex structure involves, I talked then about a reduction from UN, M to UN cross UN. And we've also seen this picture in these G2 cross G2 structures. So it's this decomposition of T plus T star into two transverse subbundles, orthogonal subbundles. Okay, now, in particular, because V is, so the metric on V is positive definite, okay, this is supposed to be positive. So the assumption in the definition of a generalized Kähler metric was that this inner product is positive definite. That was one of the statements. Now, so if we... Well, I have a V in here. It's the decomposition of a vector in here under this orthogonal decomposition. So this inner product, spelled out in terms of V and W, is the difference of the two induced inner products, because these are orthogonal. To say that's positive definite means that this is positive and negative. So in particular, if V is positive definite, this implies that V intersection T is 0 and V intersection T star, because T and T star are isotropic. Right? The metric is totally zero on T and T star, and therefore this has zero intersection. So that says that we can think of V as the, if you like, as the graph of a homomorphism from T to T star. Yeah, I mean, there it is. And what is a homomorphism from T to T star? Well, it's a section of T star tensor T star. So I can write that as G plus B, where this is symmetric and this is skew symmetric. Right? It's just a tensor, I just decompose it into its symmetric and skew symmetric parts. So then, so what is V? So V, well, V, I can identify V with T, so if you like, because its projection onto T is an isomorphism, because it doesn't intersect T star, I can make an identification here. So if you like, the tangent bundle is isomorphic to V by the map. I take a tangent vector and I map it to X plus this thing. So this tensor, and I just want to use this, it's sort of useful to use the interior product. I mean, normally we use the interior product for a vector and a two-form, but you know what I mean, it's a contraction on the symmetric part as well. So this is the way that we describe the subbundle V as the graph of this map. And now if we look at the induced metric on T, so you know we can define a metric on T by looking at the induced metric on V. So this is X plus IXG plus B, X plus IXG plus B. And then what is this? It's the contraction of this and this. So this is, by definition, this is GXX plus BXX. And of course, this is skew symmetric, so that goes to zero. So this symmetric part is actually a metric on T. We can interpret it as a metric on T. So the V is determined by a metric on T and this skew form B. This two-form B. Now, of course, well, I mean, expressions like G plus B are quite familiar, in, I'm sure, for many of you. But anyway, here it's just appearing in this context. Okay, so what we've got so far then is a metric on T in this induced way, and in fact, V perpendicular is the same thing with minus G plus B. So we get the same metric, but it's opposite on V perpendicular. But when I say the same metric, you know, if we identify with T, then it's the same, it's the, you know, it's the opposite metric. So we've got a metric that there, at least on T now. So now let's go back to V and say, well, V, because J1 commutes with J1, J2, right? Then we know that J1 actually preserves V. Right? So, but V is identified with T in this way, and J1 squared is equal to minus 1. So this defines a complex structure. I plus, say. And then we can do similarly with J2 and get a complex structure I minus. So what we have then, we can decompose V, or its complexification, into the 1, 0 and the 0, 1 vectors, right? The plus I and minus I eigenspaces of J1. So these are the, if you like, this is the, these are the 1, 0, and these are the 0, 1 vectors. So we have now, and then identifying V with T, this gives us this, okay, this almost complex structure. So at the moment, it's just an almost complex structure. So the first thing we have to do is to prove that it's integrable. Okay, so the picture is this. You see, we have V plus, plus V plus bar, plus V minus bar. We have a decomposition. So this gives us V, this gives us V perpendicular, but then we have So we have this decomposition of the complexification into these four pieces. How do we prove integrability? Well, we've got to use integrability of the generalized complex structure. So remember that the plus I eigenspace of J1 on T plus T star is going to be this plus, which way around is it? This plus this, and the other one is this plus this. So what we know is that what we're looking at, this V plus here, is actually the intersection of the plus I eigenspace, if I've got my signs right, of I and the minus I eigenspace of J, because on V, J1, J2 is equal to plus 1. I think I've got that one right. But so we know that by integrability, that sections of this are closed under a Courant bracket. Sections of this are closed under Courant bracket. So therefore, sections of the intersection are closed under Courant bracket. So integrability, closed under Courant bracket implies that actually sections of V plus are also closed under the Courant bracket. But what are sections of V plus? Well, I'll be a bit more specific in a minute. But sections of V plus are, I can really think of as identified with 1-0 vectors on T. So put another way, we can say that a section of V plus is equal to x plus this ix g plus b, where I plus X is equal to IX. So that's by definition of I plus. Okay, the identification of V with the tangent bundle of M is given by the graph of this map. So if I have two such things, then if I take the bracket, then the vector field part of the Courant bracket is just the ordinary Lie bracket. So if I know that, so this says that if I, so to say that this also lies in V plus means in particular that the vector field part lies inside V plus. So this implies that if X is of type 1, 1, if X and Y, are of type 1, 0, then XY is of type 1, 0. And that's the integrability condition for I plus. Okay, by the Newlander-Nirenberg there. So we've got a metric, we've got complex structures compatible with a metric, and those, so I can do the same thing for the other side. I have I plus and I minus, they're both integrable. So we've got part of it. Now, what about all this stuff involving the connections? Now, that's going to involve the second part of the Courant bracket. Okay, so it's sort of convenient to actually use that integrability and use complex vectors. So suppose that now that Z1 up to Zm are holomorphic local coordinates with respect to I plus. Then we can define, so V plus is then defined as, so V plus is a set of things, is spanned, locally spanned by things like d by dzi plus the interior product of d by dzi with g plus b. But now g is Hermitian, so we can actually rewrite that we can rewrite that in terms of the Kähler form. I think I've got my sign right. It's minus I omega plus b. Okay, if I use d by dzi bar, I would have plus I omega plus b here. So on any vector, you know, it's this symmetric part, but when we restrict to these 1-0 vectors, then we can replace the symmetric matrix by its by the Kähler form. So now, in this case, what we see is that, of course, that the Lie bracket of d by dzi and d by dzj is equal to 0. So when we take the Courant bracket of these two things, then the vector field part of that is going to be equal to 0. On the other hand, this lies inside this V plus, but V plus is identified with T1, 0, and so if the vector field part of it vanishes, then the rest of it vanishes. Okay. So actually what we're going to have is that the fact that this is closed under Courant bracket means that if I take d by dzi plus this interior product with this form, then this is going to be equal to 0. So this gives me an equation to work out for relating B and the two form omega. So this is not a closed form. So now you can figure it out directly, but maybe the better way to do it is to say that the Courant bracket, what was the characteristic property of the Courant bracket? It was that it was invariant under the action of a closed B field. And the action, this is precisely what the action is. So here is a two-form. The action was take a tangent vector plus its contraction with two-form. So this would certainly be true if minus I omega plus B was equal to, it was a closed form. But if you look at the proof, what you'll see is that if B is not closed, then if you look at the transformation A of X plus Xi is equal to X plus Xi plus IXB, then the Courant bracket, I apply A to the Courant bracket, and I look at the difference between that. So this is, it's clear that this is going to involve the exterior derivative of B. And what is it? It's, if I've got the sign right anyway, it's Ix, Iy, dB. So when you have a non-closed two-form, it changes the Courant bracket, and this is what the difference is. So here we replace B by this complex form. And if we know that this is equal to 0, and the thing that we're starting with is equal to 0, then we must conclude that this is equal to 0. In other words, that in this particular case, I of d by dzi, I of d by dzj, evaluated on d of this one, minus I omega plus b, is equal to 0. So what does that mean? So we're contracting with some 1-0 vectors. So that says that, that d of I omega minus I omega plus b, if we look at the 2-1 part plus the 3-0 part, then that is going to be equal to 0. Okay, these are the only parts which give us something non-zero after contracting with these two holomorphic vectors. So omega is already of type 1-1, and the complex structure is integrable. So this this says that minus I times times curly b omega. That's the 2-1 part. There's no 3-0 component to this. And if I now take the if I look at b of the 1-1 part of b, and that's the that's that. So that's the 2-1 part, and the 3-0 part is curly d of b 2-0. So this equation gives me these two equations here. So, well, we're almost there. So now, what does that say? So that says that if I look at plus d bar of b. I'm just looking at the. I thought I got enough there. No, that's all right. Minus I. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Plus D bar. Thank you. Plus D bar of B 2-0. That's right, yeah. So now if you take that as its complex conjugate, then, okay, so I have minus I D omega plus D B 1-1 plus D bar B 2-0 is equal to 0. Take its complex conjugate, and that's this plus D bar B 1-1. Plus d of b 0-2 is equal to 0. And so add that together, you get I into d minus d bar omega is equal to dB. Don't usually do proofs, but I think it's useful to see the properties of the Courant bracket coming out into this proof. So that's virtually it, because actually if you then consider the way in which the Chern connection is related to the Levi-Civita connection. It's a standard formula that if you take the Levi-Civita connection plus, well, you raise indices using the metric, the half I d minus d bar omega, this is equal to the Chern connection. So this tells us that when raising and lowering indices, that actually the torsion of the Chern connection is dB, and therefore you get the same answer using the complex structure I minus as well. Okay, so that's sort of it's a proof going one way. If you go the other way, there's a slight technicality you need. It's you have this you've got to prove integrability of the generalized complex structure J1. You've got sections of V plus closed under Courant bracket, sections of another one of these pieces. You have to prove that the cross terms vanish as well. But this, I think, is sufficient for at least for this lecture. Sufficient for me, anyway. So what do we deduce from this? That here is this natural geometric structure phrased in terms of generalized complex structures, and when you spell it out in terms of ordinary differential geometry, it comes down to this structure. Well, I want to try and convince you that in fact there is a payoff. That is, if you want to construct examples of manifolds of this type, metrics of this type, you can actually use the formalism of generalized complex structures. And I should mention that, in fact, there's some pure mathematicians have been particularly interested in this recently, in the past few years, in four dimensions. So Postoloff, Gourdouchon, and Grantcharov. They've written various papers on bi-Hermitian structures. So bi-Hermitian structure. So bi-Hermitian structure means you have a metric and you have two integrable complex structures compatible with the metric. You don't have this extra condition involving the torsion. But in four dimensions, it's not so far apart. One of the reasons that they're interested in this is that in four dimensions, if the complex structures are give the same orientation, then this has an interesting. I mean, these are interesting metrics because the self-dual part of the Weyl tensor has a specific algebraic form, a rather degenerate algebraic form. So it's somewhere in between self-dual metrics and general metrics. So it's quite interesting actually to study from a purely differential geometric point of view. So these authors, or subsets of them, have a number of papers published on this. I may come back to that. And one remark. So what I want to do is actually to look at the four-dimensional situation from the point of view of generalized complex structures and show how it gives you an ansatz, if you like, for constructing these metrics. But before I do that, let me just point out one thing. That is that I have this picture, right? There's a question about odd and even. So so I haven't emphasized this very much, but every one of these generalized complex structures comes in an odd type or an even type, depending on whether the pure spinner, which defines it locally, is an odd spinner or an even spinner. Or if you like, depending on whether you take the odd spin representation or the even one. And to get a generalized Kähler structure, you have a pair of these, so you need to know when, can you choose an odd one, an even one, or an even one? So what it turns out is the following, that so there are these relations on maximally isotropic subspaces, which are all to do with, intersection properties of subspaces on quadrics. So if you have, an odd isotropic subspace intersected with an odd, or an even intersected with an even, then this is even dimensional. And if you have odd intersection even, then this is odd dimensional. So in this case, these spaces are intersections of maximally isotropic subbundles. So what is this? What is the dimension of this? It's the complex dimension of the manifold itself. Right. So what we see here then is if the complex dimension of M is odd, then you have to take an even and an odd generalized complex structure. So you need even J1 and odd J2. So. And if the dimension is even, there are two possibilities. You can have even and even, or odd and odd. So even dimensional complex manifolds, there are two different types of generalized Kähler structure, but in odd dimensions there's just one. I just mentioned that because I'm going to talk about four manifolds, and there are actually two types, though mainly I'll be talking about the even kind. Okay, so let's go, because I haven't actually given many examples of anything, it's maybe profitable to look at four dimensions anyway. It's, as I say, it's important for the differential geometers because there's some relation there with self-duality. And it's actually a reasonably accessible part of this whole thing. So let's just think about what we're talking about now, about generalized complex structures or generalized Kolarov-Yau structures in dimension 4. So that means that we're looking at the group spin 4, 4, properties of spin 4, 4. And of course, this is eight dimensions. What we have is triality. So triality says that the two spin representations and the vector representation are all equivalent under some outer automorphism. But for our purposes, what it means is that they all have the same internal structure. You know, if you look at one of these spaces, you couldn't tell whether it was a spin space or the vector representation. So in particular, what it means that the spinners, so the spin space is an eight-dimensional space with a quadratic form. That's all the internal structure. Non-degenerate quadratic form, just the same internal structure as the vector representation. Now, all of our data here is described in terms of pure spinners. And as I said, pure spinners in general, well, it's a bit difficult to get your hands on them. We have this stratification using exponentials and so on. But here in eight dimensions, what is a pure spinner? It's simply a null spinner. So pure, because there's only one non-trivial distinguished orbit under the complexified group. So a pure spinner is, in this case, exactly the same as a null spinner. In other words, if I think of the even case, so mainly I'll be talking about the even case, then if I have an even form, degrees 0, 2, and 4, then that's pure if and only if it's 0 under the Mukai pairing, which says that phi 2 squared is equal to 2 phi 0 phi 4. So these are the pure spinners in this dimension. Well, before I go to the generalized Kähler structure in this dimension, let me just give you, as an example, a characterization of generalized Kolbe-Yau manifolds, let's say even ones, in four dimensions, because it's sort of an application of this. So here, this is, if you like, an aside, because I haven't given many examples. And after this, we'll go on to consider how to solve these equations by using this generalized formalism. So the aside is to consider generalized Kolbe-Yau structures in four dimensions. I've given you examples, but actually we can say what they are here, because it brings out the role of this Mukai pairing. So what do we require? So first of all, we require that we have a pure spinner, so that we have phi phi is equal to 0, and also that phi phi bar is not equal to 0. And that was the condition which gave us that E and E bar were intersected in 0. So, so there are two cases here. This is a closed form. So d phi is equal to 0, so that implies that phi 0 is a constant. So if phi 0 is not equal to 0, then by rescaling, we could make it equal to 1, say. Then what does this equation tell us? It tells us that phi 2 squared is equal to 2 phi 4, and so phi 0 plus phi 2 plus phi 4 is equal to 1 plus phi 2 plus phi 2 squared over 2. So this is the exponential of phi 2. Okay. So it's looking like, so in terms of real and imaginary parts, it's looking like e to the b plus I omega, except we just have to prove that omega is symplectic. Phi 2 is closed, so it's looking like a B-field transform of a symplectic structure. But where does this come from here? So we've got to look at this condition here. So we want to look at the e to the phi 2 in a product e to the phi 2 bar. We want that to be non-zero. So when is that non-zero? Remember that this Mukai pairing is orthogonal with respect to the B field. So exponential of a B field is an orthogonal transformation with respect to this Mukai pairing. So this is just e to the phi 2 minus phi 2 bar times 1. So the Mukai pairing gives us, this is plus or minus, this phi 2 minus phi 2 bar squared over 2. So if that's not equal to 0, that tells us that the imaginary part of phi 2 is indeed symplectic. So what we deduce is that if phi 0 is not equal to 0, then what we get is a B-field transform of a symplectic structure. So the second case is that if phi 0 is equal to 0, then the condition, so phi phi is equal to 0, the purity condition implies that phi 2 squared is equal to 0. And this tells us, of course, that just remember the formula for the Klein quadric, that phi 2 is locally decomposable. Phi 2 is locally decomposable. So if it's non-zero, it's expressible locally as the wedge product of two complex one forms. Now if we look at this, the non-degeneracy of this, if you look at phi, phi bar, then this is equal to, in this case, phi 2 wedge phi 2 bar. So this tells us that theta 1 wedge theta 2 wedge its conjugates is non-zero. Well, this implies actually that you have an almost complex structure, that theta 1 and theta 2 span the 1-0 forms for an almost complex structure, and because so we have an almost complex structure, and if d phi 2 is equal to 0, that implies that it's integrable. So what we have here is a genuine Calabi-Yau manifold. We're in four dimensions, so we might as well say that we have a trivial canonical bundle, so it's either a K3 or a torus. There's one more aspect to this. We haven't discussed phi 4. So, phi, this top degree component, there are two cases here. There's no harm in actually perhaps giving you some arguments, explicit arguments here. So what I want to prove is that this really is a B-field transform of an ordinary Calabi-Yau structure. So phi 4, there are two possibilities. The first is that if phi 4 is exact, so it's an exact top degree form, then actually if you're on a, so we know that any K3 surface and any torus is Kähler, so we automatically have the dd bar lemma. So that implies that actually phi 4 is equal to dd bar of, what have I called it, beta of a 1-1 form. So this is equal to minus d bar of d beta 1-1. So that's a 2-1 form. On the other hand, so d beta 1-1, so this is a 2-1 form. We have this non-vanishing holomorphic 2 form, so this is equal to phi 2 wedged with, what have I called it, theta 0-1 form. Okay, wedging with phi 2 gives us an isomorphism between 0-1 and 2-1. So now if we put b equal to minus d of theta 0-1 plus theta 1-0, and b is a closed 2 form. And if I take, so b wedge phi 2 is then equal to d bar theta 0-1 wedge phi 2, all the other parts disappear, and that is by definition, that was d bar, have I called it? Okay, and that by definition is d, so this is phi 4. So if phi 4 is exact, then actually it's the transform of phi 2 by a closed 2 form. And if it's not exact, then you can do something similar. You can write it as phi 4 is some multiple of phi 2, which phi 2 bar, this is a closed, well, the imaginary part of, or the real part of that is a closed 2 form, and then it's something exact. So you can repeat the argument. So the upshot of this is that in four dimensions, any generalized Calabi-Yau structure on a compact manifold is either a symplectic structure transformed by a B-field, or it's a Calabi-Yau manifold, a K3 or a torus, which is transformed by a B-field. So there's nothing exotic in the language of generalized Calabi-Yau structures in four dimensions. But the case of these generalized Kähler structures is far less clear. So that's why I want to show you how this formalism helps us to find solutions to these equations for bi-Hermitian metrics. In fact, curiously enough, a formalism, the result is in one of these papers of Grantcharov and Apostolov, I think. So what do we have to do in four dimensions? We have to consider intersections. So to say that J1 and J2 commute, we've got to find some algebraic way of formulating that. But really, the essential point is that we want to know, we have this decomposition of T plus T star into these four pieces, if you remember. So what we really want to know is when is the kernel of when are the kernels of these things? You want to know when these are in this four dimensions. You want to know when these are two dimensional. Okay, so I mean, in general, these isotropic subspaces will intersect a pair of them, a pair of even ones here, will intersect in zero. But we want to get this V plus bar, etc., which is where all of these are two dimensional. So, but remember that there are two issues here. One is that if we think in terms of pure spinners, that phi psi equals zero if and only if the dimension of the intersection of the two maximally isotropic subspaces is greater than zero. And also we have parity, that even intersection even is even dimensional. So if this is equal to zero, the dimension is greater than zero and even, and therefore it's two, because that's maximum dimension in this case. 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 is 8. So this is precise. This, we can replace these commuting properties by this property here for all of these things. So what we can say is that J1, J2 is equal to J2, J1 if for, if you like, locally defined pure spinners, phi 1 and phi 2, which define these J1s and J2s, there we have that phi 1, phi 2 is equal to 0, and the complex conjugates, well, phi 1, phi 2 bar is equal to 0. Well, the other two are obtained by complex conjugation. Any one of these things is of course, we also know that, of course, that that's equal to 0 as well. So we have this nice set of algebraic equations which are equivalent to the commuting of these two generalized complex structures. So this is this you can put to use. So let me just show you how it works. Where shall we start? Start with okay, so let's start with, so these have got to be pure spinners. So let's start with, why start? Let's look at a symplectic structure. This is really the generic case. and the B field transform of another symplectic structure. So we want that this should be equal to zero, and so plus or minus this should be equal to zero. So these are our equations. So if omega 1, omega 2, and b are closed forms, then these will give us automatically a solution to these equations, because if these are closed, then the corresponding generalized complex structures, well, then we have generalized complex structures, and this gives us the a commuting property, and then maybe we need to check the positivity of the metric that comes out of it. So this condition is very easy to prove, because again, by orthogonality, this is the same as saying that e to the b plus I omega 2 plus or minus I omega 1 is equal to 0. So the condition comes down to this, that b plus I omega 2 plus or minus omega 1 squared is equal to 0. So if I have two forms, so suppose I have two forms, b and omega 1 and omega 2, which are closed and satisfy these equations, which when you spell them out become b omega 1 is equal to b omega 2 is equal to omega 1 omega 2 is equal to 0, which is omega 1 squared plus omega 2 squared minus b squared, then these give us a generalized Kähler structure. So, and by the theorem, you can find one of these bi-Hermitian metrics with the various properties that we want. Can you solve these equations? Well, in general, I don't know, but there's a particular solution which appeared in one of the papers of Apostolov, and essentially came from Dominic Joyce, I think, who was the referee of the paper. But here's an example. So first of all, there's a fairly trivial example, which is where you take a hyper-Kähler manifold, say a K3, and I've used omega there. So suppose nu 1 and nu 2 and nu 3 are the hyper-Kähler forms.
Yeah?
Well, I've got well. There's the
real imaginary parts.
Yeah, I have a plus or minus in there, right? I mean, I had real and imaginary parts and a plus or minus. 2 times 2 is 4. Yeah. Okay. Right. So in this case, if you take the B field to be nu 1, and you take omega 1 to be a half nu 2 minus nu 3. And omega 2 to be a half of nu 2 plus nu 3, then that's, so these forms, of course, satisfy the equations that nu 1 squared is nu 2 squared is equal to nu 3 squared, and nu 1, nu 2 is equal to nu 2, nu 3 is equal to nu 3, nu 1 is equal to 0. So if you make this substitution, you find a solution to this. Well, that's not very interesting, because this is a hyper-Kähler metric, it's Kähler. So as a generalized Kähler manifold, it's not very interesting. But you can deform this. So this is what Dominic Joyce pointed out. And it has there's a feature about it which I find quite intriguing. That what you do is that you take a function, a real-valued function f, and you use nu 1. So you're on a hyper-Kähler manifold still, but you use nu 1 to define a Hamiltonian vector field x. So that's relative to the symplectic structure nu 1. And then you integrate that a little bit to some symplectic diffeomorphisms. And then what do? Then you you define some new forms. You define, I can never remember what these are, so let me, so you take B again to be nu 1, and you take omega 1 to be on half of nu 2 minus the pullback by this symplectic diffeomorphism of nu 3, so this is symplectic with respect to nu 1, and you take omega 2 to be a half of nu 2 plus ft star nu 3. And the key point about this is that when you look at something like nu 1 times ft star nu 3, for example, then because nu 1 ft is Hamiltonian with respect to nu 1, this is ft star of nu 1 nu 3, which is equal to 0. And this gives a genuinely new solution to these equations on a K3 surface. Now, the intriguing thing about this, I find, is that when we're talking about generalized Kähler manifolds, then we're thinking of analogs of Kähler structures. And we know that Kähler structures are very very free. We can take a Kähler form and we can add on dd bar of a function for a suitably small function, and we get another Kähler structure. So we don't expect these generalized Kähler structures to be rigid in any sense. We expect them to have a degree of freedom. On the other hand, when you look at them from the point of view of Riemannian geometry, you see these constraints. You see the constraints on the Weyl tensor. They look like rather special metrics. But here you see an example which has exactly the same degree of freedom as adding on dd bar of a function. I mean, a function modulo constants is what you need here to get the symplectic diffeomorphism. That gives us a one-parameter family of these generalized Kähler structures. But I have no idea about whether there's any sort of general feature about this, that there's always that single functional degree of freedom there, but it's at least preserves the analogy between the two situations, just Kähler, which is fairly free, and this too, which is free. Well, you can find... Well, you can try and find other examples, but I don't want to fill out this lecture with examples. Let me just finish by saying that, well, two things. One is that, although I've said that... Well, we know. Well, obviously, I mean, you could... it has a hyperkähler. I mean, we have the ALE, ALE metrics. No. For non-Krepin. I don't know actually. Actually, there are very few methods of finding such things. So, I mean, you have a particular reason for thinking that there should be. Okay. Well, it'd be interesting to maybe try and discuss that. I mean, there are no general methods for producing these. But this particular method, at least, is something which comes down from the pure spinner generalized complex structure picture. When you go into higher dimensions, so it's in the higher dimensions, I mean, you're thinking three dimensions or something? In two dimensions. Oh, okay. Okay, well, maybe I can think about that. What is known in the compact case, so maybe I could just finish by saying what the geometers, Apostolov and the others, can say in the compact four-dimensional case, where they're actually using not the full, as I say, they're not using this torsion aspect of it, but they're just looking for bihermitian metrics. What they prove is that, well, there are two different cases. There's one is strict. So suppose that if I plus is not equal to plus or minus I minus anywhere, if that's, then that's called a strictly bihermitian metric. Then that implies that the underlying complex structure is either, if I get this right, is either a K3 surface or a Hopf surface. And you can show that actually the hop surface, in our case, doesn't occur precisely because the torsion form is, as I said, closed but not exact. So, I mean, this is not saying that every case, you know, that there's a description of every such bihomission structure on a K3 surface, simply that the underlying manifold, when it's as a complex manifold, has to be a K3 surface or a torus. In the case when, so in general, if you look at the places where I plus is equal to plus or minus I minus, and this is, so remember that yesterday I talked about these G2 cross G2 structures where we have a pair of G2 structures, and there were these, there's this integer invariant which counted the number of points at which the two coincided. So this is the same sort of picture but in four dimensions. In this case, it's not a set of points because the space of complex structures is just a P1 bundle over a four-dimensional manifold. So if I have two sections of this, they will meet in general in a surface. So what Apostolov and the others show that is that this is equal to zero on at least a component of an anticanonical divisor. So that's a section of the dual of the canonical bundle. A zero set, you know, a section of the dual of the canonical bundle. And that's an anticanonical divisor with respect to I plus and I minus. And so that enables them to look through the classification to you know, so that rules out a lot of surfaces, because most surfaces in fact don't have any anticanonical divisors. So the picture for the existence of these generalized, and of course they're always the Kähler manifolds. So any Kähler manifold is of course one of these. So the picture is in four dimensions that there is not. This is pretty uncertain. So, actually Marco told me. Sent me an email to say that he's been looking now at the deformation theory of generalized Kähler structures, where you fix the generalized one generalized complex structure and vary the other, and he says that actually within the deformations around say CP2 or CP2 with some points blown up, you can actually find generalized complex structures. So the deformation theory doesn't tell you what these things are exactly, but it does suggest that in quite a lot of these cases, you start with a Kähler metric, you deform it, and having the anticanonical divisor, as we know, gives us a non-trivial deformation of the generalized complex structure. Then you can get generalized Kähler structures on these. So the picture is looking as if this, that a generalized Kähler structure in four dimensions is either a Kähler structure or is something like what I've constructed here on a K3 surface, or can be obtained on surfaces with anticanonical divisors. Well, I've spoken now about moduli in one form or another, so my last lecture, I want to talk about the moduli problem, which is in particular the Kuranishi theorem that Gualtieri has produced, and then talk about some work of Huybrechts on the moduli space of generalized Calabi-Yau metrics on the K3 surface. Okay.
Questions? Let me remind everybody we have a fun session today at 2:00. Let's thank Nigel again.